and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kavita Akwaye. Demonstrators in Kabul have condemned President Joe Biden's order freeing up around $3.1 billion in Afghan assets held in the U.S. for families of America's 9/11 victims, saying that the money belongs to Afghans. Some of this money has been termed, in terms of the U.S. keeping it, as a form of theft. Others are saying that this money should be given to Afghans. Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the justification or lack of it from the U.S. on allocating this money to victims of 9/11, and not Afghans, who are facing a humanitarian, not to mention an economic crisis of epic proportions in their country. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have Jim Kavanaugh joining us. He's a writer and blogger at The Polemicist from New York. Also joining us, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist, who joins us from Molloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Brian Terrell, let me first start with you. You know, this has been blasted all over the place, especially in social media, about the U.S. decision or the decision by Joe Biden to do this. What is your take on the way that the U.S. went about, the thinking that it went about to make this decision? Because obviously we're looking at the situation in Afghanistan and what the Afghans are dealing with.
Well, it's... It is theft, and it's unspeakably cruel at a time like this, at a time this winter. And it's what's been happening these more than 20 years. Rather than sanctions, the United States ought to be paying reparations if there's any justice. Usually a country that carries on a war of aggression and loses, it has to pay up. And the U.S. should have no say about how that money is to be used. The average age, the median age in Afghanistan now is a few months over 18 years. So more than half the people in Afghanistan were not alive on 9/11. They do not owe any debt to the people who died on that horrible occasion here in the United States on 9/11, 2001. Most Afghans didn't know about the events of 9/11 until the bombs started dropping and the U.S. soldiers occupied. The U.S. supposedly already spent more money on the reconstruction of Afghanistan, and this is from the government's own inspector general, than the entire Marshall Plan that rebuilt Western Europe after World War II. And I visited Afghanistan. I was there, I think, seven times between 2010 and 2019. And over those years, well, there's billions of dollars were being spent on reconstruction, going to U.S. Contractors, going to Afghan oligarchs. I just saw the city, the infrastructure of the city, just decay. With every visit, the city of Kabul was more insecure, was dirtier, was
that's interesting.
Yeah, and so it's and $300 million a day spent on the war, not on the reconstruction, but on the war going in Afghanistan,
right.
And these people, the people in Afghanistan, are victims.
You know, that's a good point that I didn't think of, which I will address to you, Jim Kavanaugh, if I can. So our guest there, Brian Terrell, talks about how he has visited Afghanistan. All the money did not show itself on the ground where it should. I'm guessing from schools to hospitals to basic infrastructure, perhaps. And then now you have this incident happen in which you have the U.S. taking half of that money, which is amounts to about $3.1 billion, where you have no money circulating in the country, millions are on the brink of starvation. How did Joe Biden think that this is going to help Afghanistan and to solve its crisis?
Well, he doesn't care whether it's going to help Afghanistan solve its crisis. This is a political stunt for the American political theater. And, you know, it plays well. We're taking care of the families of the 9/11 victims. Look, I lived a half a mile from the Twin Towers on 9/11. You know, I'm all for helping the 9/11 families. The United States doesn't have to take money from Afghanistan to do that. No Afghans were involved in 9/11, even according to the official story. The plot was hatched in Hamburg, Germany. So, you know, to make the Afghans pay for this now, after 20 years of war, in which at least 50,000 more Afghan civilians were killed, you know, this is kind of a gratuitous joke to say the Afghans owe us money for 9/11. And it is a kind of gratuitous cruelty. As Brian said, you know, the money that was poured into Afghanistan didn't help real social development of the Afghan people. It went to the oligarchs and the contractors and the weapons manufacturers. And what's happened, and, you know, there was a crisis, an economic and social crisis in Afghanistan before the United States pulled out. So now they're going to make the Afghan people pay essentially this ridiculous, as Brian said, idea that the Americans go in and make war in a country for 20 years, kill 50,000 civilians, and then say, oh, you got to pay us for that. This is ridiculous. You know, it's kind of absurd. You know, when the United States defeated Nazi Germany, they didn't say, Germans, you have to, they tried that in Versailles, it didn't work very well, you have to pay us. They poured money into the country. And so, you know, they had, not only are they taking this money, but they're imposing sanctions on the government. They just want to punish the Taliban for defeating them. And Biden wants to make political capital in the United States with, look what I'm doing. I'm taking this money from the dirty Taliban to give to good American families who suffered from 9/11. And it's really, unfortunately, it's going to work well in the American theater, I think.
Well, let me ask you, if I can, I don't know if you can answer this, Brian Terrell, but talk about this decision to give the money, half of it, to the 9/11 victims and whether it's justified or not. One source, and I'm not too sure, I can't say it's authentic or not, but I'm wondering if you have an idea, said that 9/11 families have been supported financially for 20 years by states, nonprofits, and for this move, it's not right to take away from the mouths of starving Afghans and to give these 9/11 families more money. Again, as our guest there said, there's nothing wrong with giving 9/11 family members money. So I'm wondering if this was indeed something that happened where they were taken care of by states and nonprofits, and whether the decision, did it run for a second in the U.S. mind that 15 of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia and we should go be asking money from them?
I do know some people who were victims of 9/11 who don't feel like they've been compensated enough, and I don't know if they could be. But it's unclear whether this money, just as the half of the money that's going to be supposedly going to help the Afghans, whether it's going to get there or not. And also it's questionable whether this money that's been allocated for the families of the 9/11 victims, whether they're going to get it. And I think about all this money that's been spent. If the United States truly had rebuilt the infrastructure of Afghanistan, if they had actually built the hospitals that the people of the United States were billed for, that never existed, where the ground was never broken, if they had built the schools that they said that they built, and that so many Americans feel so proud of ourselves for building, if they had done that, Afghanistan would be a very secure place now, and the region would be much more secure. So this is all, you know, we're really making the world much more dangerous. And I'm glad people are out on the street in Kabul. And I'm tomorrow in many American cities, there's going to be people at American peace movement. People are going to be at federal buildings and other government facilities demanding that this. Decision be reversed,
sure.
And people will be calling the White House, and And I really hope that we will rise to that occasion and make these demands.
Well, talk about Afghans. Jim Kavanaugh, one of the Afghans out on the streets, said this, and I'm quoting him. Of course, it's been translated. "I don't think the U.S. has the right to use Afghanistan's money to compensate 9/11 victims. The U.S. had no reason when it attacked us, but a lot of people died in the past 20 years. So it's the U.S. that should compensate us, and they should not spend our money." Does he have a point?
Oh, yes. Look, even Karzai, the American installed president of Afghanistan, said this was an atrocity. You know, again, it's at least 46,000 Afghan civilians were killed for something the Afghans didn't do. And so they've, you know, paid dearly for whatever imaginary crimes the United States wanted to, you know, blame on them rather than the Saudis or the German government, which, you know, harbored Mohammed Atta. So, you know, the idea that now what we have to do is impose sanctions and take away the assets, the currency, the gold of the Afghan government to compensate ourselves for what we've done to the people of Afghanistan, it's certainly, you know, if you could find a better way for the United States to guarantee that Afghanistan is not going to be friendly to it, and guess where it's going to turn? It's not going to turn to the United States. It's going to turn to China for help and assistance. And then they'll be whining about that. So it's a very silly notion in terms of even the geopolitical intelligence of the United States. But it's also, as I say, gratuitously cruel. And it's done for Joe Biden to score political points, which he will score. And, you know, because the Republicans and his opponents would attack him if they gave the money to the Afghan government Afghan people who deserve to have it.
That's unfortunate to look at it that way, but yeah. Well, Brian Terrell, you said that a lot of the population in Afghanistan is, I think, 18 years old. I'm not too sure what percentage you used.
It's the median age is 18.
18, okay. I'm going to build on that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to build on that and come at you using that stat, along with how overall you're looking at about, based on what we have, 24 million people who are suffering from acute hunger. That's 60% of the population. Not to mention the drought, not to mention the fact that there's been recently a measles outbreak. So obviously the humanitarian aspect and the economic situation along with this is very dire. Add to that the 18-year-old average age. It sounds like this is perfect breeding ground for terrorists to exploit, which is what we have present currently in Afghanistan in terms of Al-Qaeda presence there with Khorasan. So has the U.S. thought how this can turn out to be a national security threat, maybe towards the U.S., since the U.S. president has decided to withhold this money and give it to 9/11 victims?
Well, I don't think it's in the interest of the arms manufacturers that there be, in the words of the CEO of Raytheon Technologies, that peace is not going to break out anytime soon, as he assured his the investors when Biden pretended he was going to stop arming the Saudis. So they don't want peace to break out. General McChrystal, when he was the head of U.S. forces and NATO forces in Afghanistan under President Obama, was interviewed by Rolling Stone magazine, and he said that with every innocent Afghan who's killed, we create 10 new enemies. So we see that metric on July 29th of this last year, the Ahmadi family who were killed by a drone strike, 10 people killed, 100 new enemies by General McChrystal's count were created that day. And if
100
you're
what? I'm sorry.
100 new enemies.
Right.
For everyone you kill, any innocent person, the United States creates 10 new enemies for itself. So that's good news if your investments are in Raytheon and in Boeing and in these other arms manufacturers. This is what President Eisenhower warned about in the military-industrial complex back in 1960, the fear that the United States is going to be not making weapons so it can fight wars, but making wars so it can sell weapons. I think we've really come to that, and it's just a harsh reality that a peaceful, prosperous Afghanistan that had fair and honest dealings with its neighbors, and its neighbors include Iran and include China and Pakistan. Peace breaking out in Afghanistan would be bad news for the U.S. economy, and so it's when things are so predictable, as you put it, that this is going to be a more breeding ground for more terror. Of course,
that's what happened in Iraq.
Of course it will be. And if something is that clear, so much to be inevitable, you have to suspect then that it's intentional. And on one level, this really is intentional.
Gratuitous
cruelty is there's a purpose behind it.
Sure. Okay. Well, Jim Kavanaugh, do you agree with that? Which is, if true, that is just, I'm not too sure what words to describe, because we're looking at a country that has been a victim for decades now. And it's just beyond words. And we here in Iran obviously see that, not only because of the close proximity that we have in terms of a neighbor, but also because of the influx of refugees that come into Iran, escaping what has happened there for the past decades. But do you think that is a train of thought that the U.S. perhaps has? And as our guest there mentioned, perhaps the arms manufacturers smiling at the fact that you have an Afghanistan that's in tatters.
Not only arms manufacturers, but, the great geopolitical strategist whose idea was, foment jihadi groups in the Caucasus, in the south of the old Soviet Union. Now foment jihadi groups right next to Iran. They know what's going to happen. They're not that stupid. They look that stupid, but there are people involved in this who know what's going, the inevitable results of this. They're going to create more enemies. You're going to drive people into the hands of ISIS, which is already in Afghanistan, has a presence, and other groups like that have a presence in Afghanistan. From their point of view, not only is it the permanent war, as Orwell and Julian Assange said, the point of the war isn't to end the war. The point of the war is to keep it going forever as this constant stream of profits to the arms manufacturers. But it's also a constant stream of now tension and aggravation and diversion for the countries around Afghanistan that now have to deal with those problems. And that's Iran, it's Russia, et cetera. So they want that tension there, and they want the arms, and they want the chaos, really. This is what the United States has been doing for the last 20 years, is fomenting chaos.
Well, taking a look at the act itself, Brian Terrell, it's basically, I was curious as to see the figure $10 billion also thrown in as to the real figure here held by the central bank, which is said to, once this is held, then the banks within Afghanistan, where they're starving for cash, and it's going to cause Afghan businesses and then to suffer because they don't have the money to then pay out, for example, to the citizens or to business, for example, owners. And, of course, then the access to this money is going to be withheld. And, therefore, you have an economy which, as shattered as it was, is going to just basically have the wind knocked out of it. So, this chain of events, is there's no way escaping it. Puts into question the U.S. announcement by Joe Biden that we don't want the Taliban to have access to this money. But it sounds like there's a revenge taking place against the nation of Afghanistan and its people.
These sanctions are not hurting the Taliban. In fact, they are making the Taliban stronger by, as we mentioned, the demonstrations in Kabul and the hatred toward the United States for this outrageous act. I've also had the opportunity to visit Iraq in 1998 during the sanctions there, and visited the hospitals and the schools, and the sanctions against that country were not hurting the upper crust, the cadres that were running the country. It was hurting the common people. This is something that charity is all very fine, and I think for people who are hungry, if some people do end up getting some food out of this. $3 billion that and such that they're getting. I hope it saves some lives, but But what's demanded is justice. I mean, this is just it is not an act of charity for someone to steal someone's food and then give them a few crumbs. It's not our money. And if the Taliban is not to be trusted, the United States trusted a very, very corrupt government, a narco republic, it's been called, that it put in place and supported with tons of cash for 20 years. Taliban is not going to be any worse. It isn't our money to even, we shouldn't even be thinking about it. It shouldn't be something that U.S. has any say whatsoever. It's a crime.
Well, Jim Kavanaugh, I'm wondering how the Taliban is going to position itself when it comes to the U.S. You have the spokesman for the Taliban condemning the U.S. for stealing the property of Afghan people, as he stated, posting on social media that the theft of the frozen assets shows the U.S. has degraded to the lowest level in human nature. What kind of reactions will we see from the Taliban? I'm guessing, first of all, that the Afghans are going to really rally perhaps behind the Taliban, because in essence they're seeing this face of the U.S. So that's one of the outcomes here. But regarding the Taliban, what can we see from them?
Well, they'll certainly rally against the United States. And briefly, at least in the short run, they'll rally around the Taliban government. But the Taliban are in a difficult position, and they're economically weak, and they're going to need help. I think what you're going to see from the Taliban, as I suggested, is they're going to have to turn to other people who are capable and willing to help them, you know, in a non-cruel way, in a just respectful, bilateral way. So that's likely to be the neighbors, Iran, Russia, China, Pakistan, you know, and these are the places that they're going to have to look for help. In terms of the Taliban is a governing party, that they have to find some help for themselves. So that's what they're likely to do. Politically on the ground, it's going to be anti-American, pro-Taliban. If the Taliban can succeed in getting help from other countries, they will definitely cement their position politically in relation to the masses in Afghanistan. So that's what we're going to see, that playing out over the next few months, probably. And because it's an emergency, and somebody, they have to get something from somebody. And, there aren't 100 actors that can save them. There are, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 in the world.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist from Molloy, Iowa. Thank you so much. Jim Kavanaugh, thank you for your contribution. Writer and blogger, The Polemicist from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikava Tahwai, entire team here in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Almighty Allah, you are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
We're waiting for you to be by your side.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I'm your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, as you know, in this program, we try to provide you a very clear picture of Imam Mehdi so that we will be among his soldiers, inshallah. And today we will be discussing an interesting topic, in fact, a doubt that Wahhabis enter into the Mehdaviyat. And on that note, today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
How have you been?
Alhamdulillah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for accepting the invitation.
My pleasure.
Dr. Karimi, Wahhabis say that the narrations are from Shia authentic books that say that Imam Mehdi, when he will reappear, he's going to demolish Masjid al-Haram, the Holy Kaaba, and Masjid al-Nabawi, or the Prophet's Mosque. How true is that? Is that correct?
As you rightly mentioned, this is one of the questions and one of the ways that the Wahhabis try to reject the concept of Mahdawiya, or at least to, portray it in a way that it is against the religion of Islam, because according to some of these Wahhabis, they claim that Imam Mahdi, as you mentioned, will destroy two very holy places for all Muslims, that is Masjid al-Haram in the holy city of Mecca, and the Mosque of the Prophet, Masjid al-Nabi, in the city of Medina.
Medina.
Now, the first very important point is that, are the Wahhabis allowed to mention such a thing? What do I mention that? Because when we refer to the books of the Wahhabis, we see that there are many outstanding great Wahhabi scholars that they have mentioned that, for example, when it comes to the Mosque of the Prophet, we need to destroy it and just return it to the way it was before.
All right.
So, I mean, even if Imam Mahdi al-Islam is going to do that or not, I will discuss about that. My point is that Wahhabis are not in a place
Wahhabis.
To mention that.
Yeah, you're trying to say that Wahhabis who themselves say that we need to demolish Prophet's grave are coming and giving such a...
Not the grave, I mean, you're talking about mosque.
Yeah.
So they also have the same notion in their books.
Yeah.
So let me just share a few of these passages from the great Wahhabi scholars. Albani is one of the most famous Wahhabi scholars in recent years. He has a book. Its title is Tahdhir al-Sajid min Ittikhadh al-Qubur Masajid, referring to the fact that we are not allowed to take the graves as the mosques.
Okay.
So in one part of his book, he talks about the Mosque of the Prophet in the city of Medina. I just try to translate a part of what he has mentioned regarding that. He says that one of the very unfortunate points is that the prophetic mosque, Masjid al-Nabi, has been built in many centuries ago. Otherwise, we should have demolished that green dome too. And also he continues to say that beside the holy grave of the Prophet, there are some windows of copper, some curtains, some paintings. And the owner of the grave, that is the Prophet, is not satisfied with all of them. Again, he says that in the year 1368, when I went to visit the grave of the Prophet, I saw a place which was, higher than the surface of the mosque. And it was mentioned there that this is special for prayer behind the grave of the Prophet. And then I wonder why this symbol of polytheism is still there in the monotheistic rulership. He's referring to the government of the Saudis.
Okay.
And then he says that, so finally he comes to this point that 3 years ago in another book I mentioned that we need to, somehow demolish the Mosque of the Prophet and make it as it was like before. So, for example, he mentions that between the mosque and the grave of the Prophet, from north to the south, there must be a wall so that inside the mosque there is nothing which is against the will of the Prophet, and it is incumbent upon the Saudi government to do that if they are really supporting real monotheism.
It's so interesting. They are putting their wishes into the as the wills of Prophet. It's very interesting that what they want to do. They're saying like it was Prophet's will.
And not only that, he says that that was my suggestion 3 years ago, but now I have come to know that the Saudi government, they have decided to even extend the mosque, and which is completely against my suggestion, and I hope that they are going to do that in future. So this is the wish of Albani, the famous Wahhabi scholar asks the Saudi government somehow to demolish the prophetic mosque in one way and just...
One or the other way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The other Wahhabi scholar is named Sheikh Muqbil bin Hadi al-Wadi'i. In his book, Riyadh al-Jannah, Fir Radd ala A'da'i Sunnah, He says the following. He says, I'm saying that while the dome of the Prophet is next to me, we wish to see the pickaxes hit the prophetic mosque and to just level it with the soil. This is another Wahhabi scholar referring to his wish that the prophetic mosque should be destroyed. So that is one point. The point is that the Wahhabis have a claim against Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and the claim is that he will destroy Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi. But the point is that this is also their wish. So if Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to do that, this is what they are wishing for. And
they're trying to fire from someone else's shoulder.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's the point. Having said that, let's see if this is a truth or not, if Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will do that or not.
The listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. This thousand-year-old
There is a narration mentioned by Allama Maylisi and Sheikh Tusi, which is quoted from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. According to this narration, Abu Basir says that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will come, he will destroy Masjid al-Haram so that to restore its original foundations and to retain the place of Ibrahim, that is Maqam Ibrahim, to its original place where it was. So we have this narration mentioned in some books like by Sheikh Mufid in Al-Irshad, volume 2, page 383, by Tabarsi in I'lam al-Wara, volume 2, page 289, and a few other Shia scholars. Again, we have another version of it. According to that narration, the narrator says, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said the following: إِذَا قَامَ رَدَّ الْبَيْتَ الْحَرَامِ إِلَىٰ أَسَاسِهِ. It is after the Qiyam, after the uprising of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, that he will return the mosque in the city of Mecca to its foundation, and also Masjid al-Rasul إِلَىٰ أَسَاسِهِ. Not only that, وَمَسْجِدَ الْكُوفَ إِلَىٰ أَسَاسِهِ. He will do that regarding the mosque of Kufa as well.
So are these narrations trying to say that Imam will actually correct the wrongdoings of what Wahhabis have done so far?
That's a good point. Before going to the content, first of all, like always, we need to analyze the chain of the narration.
Yeah.
So all in all, we can say that we have three narrations in this regard. Referring to the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will destroy Masjid al-Haram, not destroy, just to
demolish.
Return it to its, original foundations.
All
like,
right.
It's a kind of change. It's not, destroying the whole mosque. So these two concepts are completely different.
Yeah, correcting something and demolishing something are two different points.
Exactly.
And so they are trying to connect two things that are poles apart.
So as far as the chain of the narration is concerned, the first narration quoted from Sheikh Mufid and others, the chains of the narrations are not mentioned. Technically, we call it a mursal narration, which makes it a weak narration. So we cannot refer to that. The second narration quoted by Kulaini and other, again, some of the people in the chain of the narrations are not mentioned. So again, it is a weak narration. And in the third narration, the chain is mentioned, but one of the narrators is Ali ibn Abi Hamza al-Bata'ani, who is a very weak narrator of the narration from the time that he became as one of the leaders of Waqifis, those who rejected the imamate of Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam and stopped with the imamate of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, and they are called Waqifis. So the first point is that what is mentioned as an accusation against Imam Mahdi alayhi salam by these Wahhabis is based on three narrations which, according to us Shia, they are rejected. We cannot consider them as authentic narration. Now, the first point is that these narrations are not true narration, authentic narrations. But let's go to the content of the narration. Let's assume that the narrations are authentic. Can we find any logical meaning, understanding of these narrations? The point is that, according to us, the Shia, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is the Imam, so he is blessed with the divine knowledge. He is the most knowledgeable person when it comes to the halal and haram, the permitted action and the forbidden action. So for sure, even if he is going to, change some parts of the Masjid al-Haram and some parts of Masjid al-Nabi, which may need a kind of demolishing some parts, it is within the Islamic laws. And one of them is that, for example, the mosque of the Prophet, of course all the mosques, but especially the mosque of the Prophet and Masjid al-Haram, cannot include a land which has been usurped. Now the question is that, has it happened in the history of Islam? The answer is that, unfortunately, we have some indications in some books which tell us that yes, at least in some periods in history, some caliphs, they tried to, take the land around the Prophetic Mosque or Masjid al-Haram by force from the people. So people were not happy with that.
Oh.
Now the question is that, if Imam Mahdi alayhi salam tells the people that this part of Masjid al-Haram, for example, is taken through usurpation by force.
It was taken by force.
Yeah, the owner was not happy.
All right.
So can we, as Muslims, imagine now, we know that this part, the owner was not happy to give it to those people, to those caliphs. So for sure, all Muslims agree that we are not allowed even to, a step in that part.
Yeah, we have a concept of haqqun nas
exactly.
In Islam.
So this is one of the, very important points regarding these narrations. Yes, it is likely that because of the fact that some parts of these lands may have been taken by force by some people. Even today, we know that how extension has been made to Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi. So there is a possibility that, some parts belong to people who were not happy with them to be a part of the mosque. Inshallah, I will explain it more in the following session.
Inshallah. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Inshallah, we'll expand the topic in next session. Dear listeners, thank you for listening. You were listening to the IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Despite a statement by Lebanon's Interior Minister Bassam Maulawi last week directing security forces to cancel any event critical of the Bahraini regime, prominent Bahraini opposition group Al-Wifaq held its scheduled event. The event, titled United for Justice, marked 11 years since Bahrain witnessed popular uprising demanding justice and political freedom.
As Bahraini opposition and Bahraini factions, we are working on unifying our stances. What unites us is more than what divides us. We're united in our cause, and our demands for justice and freedom are one.
Those who support the Bahraini opposition believe that the Bahraini people's struggle for freedom and any people's uprising for the sake of reform is similar to the Palestinian people's struggle for liberation from the Israeli occupation.
The struggle to face the forging of people's will and theft of their rights and resources and the hijacking of political decision, as well as fighting for human rights in Bahrain, are similar to facing the Zionist enemy in Palestine and facing corruption and wrong in Lebanon and facing the conspiracy in Syria. This is one confrontation and one battle. The Bahraini normalization of ties and the visit of the Israeli Prime Minister prove what we have been calling for in the last 10 years.
The political representatives and Muslim clerics attending the event stressed that as Lebanon has always been a place for freedom of speech, opposition members of any country, as well as the Bahraini opposition groups, should be allowed to come here and speak. In addition to a violent crackdown on peaceful protesters, the Bahraini regime has now taken the lead in its normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, thereby going against its people's main cause. Experts believe this issue could further energize the Bahraini opposition in its struggle to be heard. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalized several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over and radicalize schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed and we witnessed this firsthand was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts, but this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized, I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Sadhika, a 12th grade student in New Delhi, is outraged. She says it could perhaps be the first time in Indian history a particular community is being targeted for what they wear. Earlier, it would be our mosques, what we eat, our marriages, our personal laws. Now it's what we wear.
Being an Indian, we are very proud to be here, and we feel like every human being has a right to decide. They have their own choice. We don't need to interfere between their choices. The constitution also gives us right like that.
Last week, a video circulating on social media became a sensation within a few hours. A young college student from the southern Indian state of Karnataka was heckled by a group of saffron-clad Hindu students chanting slogans hailing Hindu deity Rama. The girl responded back with a similar reaction, chanting Allahu Akbar, which means God is great. The incident blazed the public sentiments, with many calling the girl lioness, while others hailed her an Iron Lady. As India's state elections are underway, experts say polarizing the voters is a common phenomenon in India, with religion being the easy tool.
All effort is to try to erase Muslims from public places and to prevent them from being seen in public and impose apartheid on Muslim women. They are trying to achieve that target, but it's not as easy as they are thinking.
Another college student who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the ruling BJP might rewrite the constitution considering their policies and actions they are imposing in a country.
It's the personal choice of a person to wear whatever they want to do, and according to constitution we have the rights. It's totally a sad thing, and it's really like particularly targeting a particular community due to which we start living in a threat.
Ban on Islamic handscarves has outraged the Muslim community, saying it's an outright attack on their faith, which the constitution guarantees to safeguard. They say it could perhaps be an attempt to prevent Muslim women from attaining education or to flare communal tensions amid elections. Observers say anti-Muslim rhetoric has flared aggressively since BJP formed the government in 2014. They say since 2014, most of the elections in India were overly polarized. Religious divide has been the main trump card of the current administration. Based on rights groups, the ruling BJP has adopted various laws and policies that legitimize violence and targeting religious minorities. Experts say it's a larger political agenda to make India a supremacist Hindu nation. Meanwhile, protesting student groups have defended the use of hijab, saying the constitution guarantees them religious freedom. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
People from all walks of life held a rally Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, especially those held under administrative detention. The event is part of a week-long national campaign in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. This as Palestinian prisoners observed a one-day hunger strike on Monday in all Israeli prisons.
We are here to send a message of solidarity to administrative detainees and to all the prisoners. We will not let the prisoners down, and we will spare no effort to release them. We also call on all international agencies to stop Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are denied basic rights. Last month alone, Israeli regime forces arrested 504 Palestinians, including 50 children.
We are here to call on Palestinian resistance factions to support the prisoners and exert pressure on the Zionist regime to release them. Our enemy doesn't want peace and only understands the language of force and the language of armed resistance.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world turns a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Administrative detainees are currently boycotting Israeli courts because their detention is illegal. They are being held under secret evidence under inhumane conditions. Administrative detention is an Israeli policy to make prisoners suffer.
Palestinian administrative detainees are being held without charge or trial, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Currently, the Israeli regime keeps more than 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention, including women and minors. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's major performing arts event, Fajr International Theater Festival, wrapped up with an award ceremony on Tuesday. During the 40th edition of the annual event, theater ensembles from Iran and the world took to the stage to perform plays. And the best performances are now honored here.
It's important that we as young actors are evaluated by the jury. This gives us a stronger motivation to continue to make progress. I thank the organizers of the Fajr Theater Festival.
I was awarded for Best Playwright and Direction in the Radio Theater category. This is my second Fajr Award. My first experience at Fajr was at the age of 24.
Theater is the mother of cinema. Look at the great names in cinema industry. They have all started out as stage actors and actresses. So, Fajr Theater Festival plays an important role in boosting and promoting this important art.
Theater troops from Afghanistan, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Iraq, Italy, France, Algeria, and several other countries have been performing in the 40th edition of Fajr Festival. Out of a total of 100 plays, 20 are themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War, and three others are on the endeavors of health workers during the pandemic. Stage actors believe Fajr Festival provides a platform for the audience to get acquainted with the performing art of different nations.
The festival was a big stage for troops from many parts of the world. It's so interesting for us as actors to see our fellow actors from other nations perform. It also helps us learn about their culture and literature.
Every year in February, Iran organizes Fajr Theater Festival on the anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Last year, the festival was held with no international participation due to COVID restrictions. And this year, the hosting halls have restricted their capacities to 30% amid the emergence of the Omicron variant. The 40th Fajr Theater Festival rolled down its curtain, with some winning a prize and others not. However, stage actors here say, aside from the competitive side of the event, it was a chance to learn about and enjoy the performances of other nations. And that's where the universality of the language of art comes into play. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The meeting between Vladimir Putin and Olaf Scholz was the first since Scholz's appointment as the German chancellor. During the talks, Putin called Germany one of Russia's main partners. The leaders touched upon the issue of Russia's proposals for security guarantees. The Russian president stressed that Moscow cannot turn a blind eye to how freely the United States and NATO interpret the principles of the indivisibility of security, noting that the expansion of the North Atlantic alliance to the east continues, despite the assurances of Western partners.
About the expansion of NATO, here you said a wonderful phrase. They say that Ukraine will not be in NATO in the coming years. What does they say mean? You and I must understand what is spoken in interstate relations. We have been told for 30 years that there will be no NATO expansion at all, not one inch towards the Russian borders. And today we see the NATO infrastructure right at our house.
Putin added the postponement of Ukraine's entry into the bloc will not change anything, and Moscow would like to resolve this issue now. Speaking about the escalation in Ukraine, the Russian leader called what is happening in the Donbas a genocide. On February 9th, Olaf Scholz noted that Germany is ready for dialogue with Russia at all levels and in all possible formats for the sake of a political settlement. At the same time, he stressed that Moscow should not underestimate the cohesion and determination of Germany's NATO allies.
As for the situation with the negotiations, the positions differ, but it's important that we talk to each other. The proposals that were formulated by Russia, we also do not agree with them. NATO and the EU do not agree, but they also contain points that we are ready to talk about and are ready to discuss. Now it is necessary that a dangerous situation does not arise.
The German Chancellor noted that positions of the West and Russia on security guarantees diverge, but the issue of Ukraine's membership in NATO is not on the agenda. This is while statements that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine continue to come from the West, an allegation vehemently denied by Moscow.
Germany, as an important member of NATO, could influence its partners in the bloc, who, judging by their actions, are set up for a conflict with Russia. Moscow is not satisfied with semitones and ambiguities in matters of security guarantees. Their clear fixation is necessary. Only thanks to this it is possible to achieve a diffusion of tension, which is in the interests of Germany, located in the center of Europe. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
Another bloody day has been witnessed in the occupied West Bank, this time in Jenin. 17-year-old Palestinian teen Mohammed Abu Salah was killed in the village of Silat al-Harithiyah as Israeli troops raided the town on Sunday night to demolish the home of Palestinian prisoner Mahmoud Jaradat. Dozens of Palestinians were injured by live ammunition and rubber bullets fired by the Israeli forces towards the protesters who rushed to the area to prevent the demolition. Mahmoud Jaradat is a prisoner accused of carrying out shooting last December that led to the killing of an Israeli settler near the illegal settlement of Homish.
What my dad did is a heroic act. It's a very sad and painful feeling to see our home destroyed, but we don't want to show the Israelis that we are sad. We can rebuild the home.
The Israeli forces raided the village and immediately opened fire at the protesters because youths gathered to protest the demolition. A number of them were wounded and one was killed while defending Jaradat's home. And after a few hours, the Israeli soldiers blew up the house with dynamite.
Tension continues to remain high for the third consecutive day in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Clashes have been breaking out between Palestinian residents of the neighborhood and Israeli settlers and soldiers. Paramedics say over 30 Palestinians have been injured. A dozen others were also detained. The clashes came shortly after Israeli far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gavir announced that he would be setting up an office in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to protect the settlers. Ben-Gavir had erected a tent in the front yard of Salem family home, another family in Sheikh Jarrah facing imminent expulsion.
The Israeli extremist Knesset member is leading a campaign to allow settlers to take over Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israeli regime is giving him full support, while Palestinians are defending their presence in Sheikh Jarrah and resisting the Israeli project to wipe out their existence.
Several Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah face potential eviction by settler organizations, all following last year's tensions and the May war between the Israeli regime and armed groups in the Gaza Strip. Observers today warned that Israel's continued aggression against Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and its escalating violence across the occupied territories could be the spark that sets the entire region ablaze. Because at the end of the day, Palestinians say they will remain steadfast and Tel Aviv's violence will not stop them from defending their rights. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
We'll be right back.
as Bahrainis are marking the